You're listening to Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week we are talking rice. Food director Carl Lally Music and Emil Stonik, editor of our website, basically discuss the best way to make a perfect pot of white rice. Not brown, apparently, just white. How to riff on pilaf, how to crisp up rice so that it gets all oily and crunchy and delicious, and a whole lot more. And apparently they even touch on the validity of house slippers. I've not listened to this segment yet, so I don't know what that means, but I'm sure it's interesting. After that, I sit down with Richard Lawson, film and TV critic for Vanity Fair. He also hosts Vanity Fair's podcast, Little Gold Men, because it's Oscar season right now. It's Oscar week, actually. Oscars is coming up this Sunday. So Richard and I talk about all things movies and food because they go together, you know, kind of like peanut M&Ms and popcorn. And you can even tune into Little Gold Men podcast, wherever you get your podcast from, and you can hear our own Carla Lally Music on a recent episode. All right, speaking of Carla, let's do this. Here is Carla and Emil.
Rolling.
Rice, baby. Ding, 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 ding. Rice, baby.
The time is rice.
The time is rice to talk about rice.
Rice on.
Is there anything ricer than a pot of nice?
Oh, boy.
God, we're back.
The thing we have in common is that we both love rice.
L-O-V-E.
Also, it's kind of funny that the last one we did together was beans, mm-hmm. and now it's rice. So should the next one be like sour cream?
Mm.
All things.
Oh, I would love to do an entire podcast on sour cream. That sounds so good.
Rice and beans and sour cream.
Yeah. Mm. If I could replace all of the yogurt in my life with sour cream,
sure.
How much more.
Anyway, back to rice.
Rice. We're here to talk about rice. I think of us as rice enthusiasts.
Me and you.
By no means rice experts, but, you know, I feel like we both know
I'm a great lover of rice. I've played this game with many people, but I don't know if we've ever done it. So if you had to choose
rice
between,
or bread? Rice.
No, rice or pasta.
Oh, rice.
Yeah. You know why?
Mm.
It's a whole grain.
Oh, that's so nice.
And it's a non-processed food.
That's true.
And it's just so delicious.
It's so delicious.
It hasn't been a messed with. Well, that's not true. Sometimes you wash it, you hull it, you do the things.
Rice, it's like they're taking the outside off. So it's like, you know, it's been a little bit processed.
Dealt with.
But, you know, it's like processed as much as like, you know, the tomatoes that were taken off the vine.
Right. Yes.
Well, it's different. It's,
but if I weren't feeling well and someone gave me a bowl of buttered rice, I would feel so much better.
I would feel a lot better. I feel a lot better right now if somebody handed me some
rice. I don't know when it happened for me, but like rice with butter and parm became like my like baby food getting over sickness kind of with a lot of black pepper.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
Wait, so hold on. We have to narrow our purview right now because rice, giant category, wild rice, which is not even rice.
No, that's grass.
Brown rice. Different thing.
Many different kinds of white rice.
I know. So I think we should just stick to white rice for now.
Short grain, long grain?
Well, I think we can explore the whole field.
Okay. I guess that's fine.
Well, so I mean, to me, I feel like rice, white rice, you know, for the range from like basmati to like sushi rice, it's like a spectrum from sticky to fluffy.
And then short and long.
Let's talk about short grain white rice.
Okay. Are you
a rice cooker person or are you a
No, I'm not. I have a certain amount of space that I'm willing to commit to appliances. Mm-hmm. And currently those commitments have been made and are solid. However, so I make rice in a pot just like Carol Lally.
Mm-hmm. Carol Lally being your mother.
Yes, indeed. She makes a great pot of rice. Also, I did have a rice cooker for a really short amount of time, but maybe it wasn't a great quality one. Mm. And I never really got it. We didn't communicate.
Uh-huh, right.
And the rice wasn't better. In fact, the rice was worse.
Okay.
And it had made me soak the rice. And I was like, I don't understand. Yeah. But in the kitchen, we do use kind of the Cadillac of rice cookers.
We
have the Zojirushi, like, you know, Escalade, basically. Right. And it is...
The one that says fuzzy logic on it?
Yeah, it has fuzzy logic, and it
Nobody
does all...
Knows what it does.
No, we don't... But it does a great job at what it right. does. But it is the size of, like, a small Corvette.
Yeah.
You know?
The smallest Corvette.
Well, it's bigger than... It's, like, a bigger than a shoebox.
It's a Corvette for a cat.
It's big. Anyway, so who has that kind of space? Not me, but we do on a daily basis... Usually in the kitchen, make a pot of rice or some sort of grain
mm-hmm.
in the rice cooker. So I know that they're fantastic. They're just not in my personal life.
Yeah.
What about you?
We have a rice cooker, but it's like a 10-cup rice cooker. It's pretty giant.
Does that mean 10 cups cooked?
10 cups raw.
Oh, wow.
Raw. Uncooked.
Yeah.
I would call it raw. But
yeah.
Yeah, but it's... So
that's like 20 cups of cooked.
Right. And so Lauren, my fiance,
mm-hmm.
grew up in a rice cooker household where there was just always a rice cooker.
Every day.
It wouldn't necessarily even be made every day. This is kind of like, this is a point of contention between us. She'll eat rice cooker rice, not on the stay warm setting, just hanging out in the rice cooker for like days afterwards.
How many days?
Like 3 days?
I would definitely eat it the next day.
If it's just hanging out in there?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well... Lauren, if you're listening, you've been validated. But I think
I don't know about 4 days.
But 4 days is really... So we've got the rice cooker. Lauren prefers to make it in the rice cooker, which is fine. But I still think like making 1 or 2 cups of rice in the 10-cup rice cooker is...
It's a little bananas.
Kind of wild.
Right.
So I've got my like little stob rice pot for mm-hmm. like 1 or 2 cups of rice that I really like. It's nice and thick. I also had a rice cooker when I was in college. Graduated from college, moved into my first apartment, managed to lose the rice cooker, and then was just like completely just depressed because I could have no rice. I didn't know how to make it.
Mm.
And every time I made it in a pot, it was always too sticky or right. it was mushy or it was crunchy or whatever. And then I found on bonappetit.com the perfect pot of rice.
Amazing.
The recipe.
Yeah.
Which is... I mean, like, it
I
just
believe,
has,
does it have my byline on it?
I think it might.
I think it was from the Korean grilling story. And so that's...
No, because the Korean grilling story was pre...
Oh, that was chopstick ready rice.
That was chopstick ready rice.
Which is also good.
And this, and I think the perfect pot of rice recipe actually calls for long grain, but it's what I use for long grain, short grain, any white rice.
Okay, so walk us through it. What is your white rice of choice in the Stonic domicile?
We get the like 15 pound bags of the Coco Rose from the H Mart or another Asian grocery store. It's normally with like the red on
mm-hmm.
it. It's from California.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good. It's not like super expensive, but it's not like cheap.
Right. Nice whole grains,
mm-hmm,
no
mm-hmm.
bits. And
No. And so that recipe does not call for rinsing.
Right.
But I often do. You know, and sometimes I don't rinse. And, you know, when I don't rinse, can I necessarily tell? I'm not totally sure. But, you know, in packet processing and packaging and getting shaken up on trucks and whatever, the rice gets banged around, and so there's kind of like a fine layer of rice dust
mm-hmm.
all over everything. So that, and that's necessarily kind of starchy.
Mm-hmm.
When that gets combined with the water and it gets cooked, the rice tends to be a little bit stickier
mm-hmm.
and kind of less, or maybe gummier, like
right.
less individuated. So I rinse, but I don't rinse. I don't think that recipe actually calls for rinsing. There's the method, you know, what like Andy Baragani will do, where he's like got the rice in a pot and he's like putting water on it and then shaking it around
mm-hmm.
and then pouring it off
mm-hmm.
and repeating that over and over again. That really drives me crazy. And I also feel like there's still water in it.
Right.
So I normally just put it in a sieve and then just
rinse it.
Water over it. And that's
so
kind of my
So I think the reason why there's a benefit to putting that sieve over a bowl of water and doing your rinsing
mm-hmm.
kind of in a contained environment is because you can keep an eye on what's happening with that water.
Right.
So if you're going for not quite clear, you know, or somewhere in between, or you want that water really running clear, that you're not going to really be able to tell if you just have the faucet running through the sieve.
Totally.
But it sounds like you've got like a pretty laissez-faire approach at home. You know, you're in some state of relaxation. There's music. There may be, you know,
there's music. There's dancing.
There's There may or may not be shoes. There may be an alcoholic beverage.
Always something. Shoes.
Yeah. Always shoes at home, really?
Yeah.
You have a house shoe?
I grew up in a shoes-on household.
Like your outside shoe is on inside?
Yeah, we weren't allowed to be. I mean, you could be barefoot, but yeah. You could not be in your socks in the Stonic household.
And you don't have a house shoe at home currently?
I've got a slipper. Sometimes I'll put a slipper on.
Oh.
But, you know, I mean, this is...
Yeah. Anyway, so you're, like, doing your thing, and you're jamming out with your shoes on and your drink on.
I just don't like when people ask me to take my shoes off. Unless they're going to provide me with some kind of a house shoe as a guest.
But this is your own house.
This is my own house.
I literally bring my house shoe with me when I go to stay in hotels.
When I go to shoes off households, I bring my slippers sometimes. If it's been announced previously that it's a shoes off household.
I once read that Oprah, if you go to stay at Oprah's house and you're a guest... then in your bedroom, you will find slippers of all sizes.
Yo, that's what... I've never thought that my aunt, Mariola, and Oprah had something in common. When you go to my aunt's house, which is also her acupuncture practice, she has a giant woolen slipper that is full of pairs of woolen, like felted wool slippers in many different sizes.
Amazing.
Backless. And so you just, because she doesn't,
you just
she
ease
also,
right into it.
For different, she doesn't believe in wearing your outside shoes in the house, but also doesn't believe in being barefoot. She
right.
thinks it's bad.
I'm with you.
It's bad for you and
bad
it's
bad juju.
Bad juju.
Okay. So you're at home, you're rinsing rice, and you're like, I'm going to take off a little bit of this excess starch, but I'm not right. going totally crazy. I'm rinsing it. But then some rice also does have just more of a glutinous property to it. So
totally.
Sushi, Japanese rice, short grain. I know we're sort of all over with the grains, but also arborio and cannaroli, like the rices that are typically used to make
risotto.
And when I worked at one of the restaurants I worked in, we actually used a Japanese short grain rice to make risotto because it had all of those same starchy properties, which is also why you stir it the whole time, because you're agitating it and you're like encouraging that surface starch to come off and make that, you know, nice creamy sauce.
So you would not rinse for a risotto?
No. And then when I did the Korean grilling primer and I interviewed six different chefs and asked them all how they make rice, every single one of them, first of all, said they do it the way their mother does it. So that was like, it was like the funny, you know, I think that cooking rice for a lot of people is like cooking eggs. Like it might seem like this incredibly simple thing, but everybody's afraid they're going to ruin it. It's one of the beginning cooks, like it's going to burn on the bottom. I'm going to scorch the pan. How much water? How long? Uncovered, covered, all of these things. Once you figure out what works for you, you know, it works.
Right. And that's like why this method for me is like, once I like learned how to do it that way, it was like, there's no changing.
Okay,
you know?
So you've got your cocoa rose.
You got the cocoa rose. Get
you
in the
get
sieve.
Get a little rinsey rinse.
Give it a little rinsey rinse. You know, I mean, if I
you're more of like an ambient, it's just like an atmospheric rinsing.
Right. It's just kind of, you know, you're just running water over it. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I don't want to wash another bowl or like, you know, it's whatever. So 1 cup of rice, rinsey rinsey, into the pot with 1 1/4 cups of cold water.
Interesting.
And, before that, though, I'll put a pinch of salt. I'll put a pinch of salt, like, kind of over the rice. And then, when you put the water in, it just kind of, like, absorbs the salt. So it's not the salt in, like, one place. You know?
Okay. Cool.
I don't know. Maybe that's
cosmic,
just,
whatever. Whatever works for you.
Bring it up to a boil.
Uh-huh.
As soon as it starts to boil, drop it down to the barrel, simmer, lid on it. 18 minutes.
What?
On the dot.
Whoa.
Take the pan off the heat, uncover. Do not uncover at any point
Never.
In that
process. If you uncover a stir, you've already ruined
it.
You might as well just
order,
give it
delivery.
To the pigs. Yeah.
Give it to the pigs. I'm really enjoying this idea of my apartment
where
right
you
now.
Are.
Where they're like, we're doing the can-can, we're drinking tropical drinks, there are pigs.
Woolen slippers for everyone.
Woolen slippers for you get woolen slippers and you get woolen slippers. So 18 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Pull it off.
Yeah.
Take the lid off.
Is this what the perfect pot of rice recipe
is? It is. It is. These
Does
are your
say
words.
Say 18 minutes?
18 minutes.
That's so funny.
18 minutes. It works every time. 18 minutes. Then wrap the lid in a clean kitchen towel and then put the lid back on. And you're not fluffing. You're not doing anything like that. Wrap the towel around the lid. Put it back on. Off the heat.
Yeah.
Wait 10 more minutes.
That is a purely humidity absorbing method.
Right. So you've gone from this place where there's like a lot of steam and moisture in it, and now you're trying to absorb some of that excess
moisture.
But
you want your hermetic, you're still hermetically sealed in there. There's still steaming going on, but that those droplets are not going back into the rice.
No, no, they're going right in that towel. And then, you know, it's like 10 minutes is when I'll start, you know, you could, but it's just going to stay warm and nothing weird is going to happen. So it's like sometimes it'll sit for 20 minutes,
yeah.
sometimes it'll sit for 30 minutes, whatever. Right. And then take that lid off and fluff up. It's perfect. It's got that perfect kind of like in between sticky fluffy where it's like you can eat it with chopsticks.
Right.
But it's not like, it's not a mush. There, you've got individual grains that are stuck together.
And so that's what Rachel Yang described as chopstick ready rice, which was like enough where it will, you can still grab it with the end of chopsticks and it's not going to just be individual grains just going, falling hither and nither and thither. But it's also not so gluey that, like you said, it just kind of all like mashes up together.
Right.
You know, the thing that I learned when I was talking to all of these chefs about rice, they were all using a short grain white rice. They were all doing a method of rice that was, you know, similar to your fiance, you know, every day. There was rice every single day. And no one ever measured anything.
Right.
So the way that people would measure was either by, you always made it in the same pot, so you knew where the water line should be. And then there was the finger test, which I thought was just like fascinating. And a bunch of different people said this, where you would put the amount of rice in that looked right and then put water in and then put your finger into the pot. And then if the water came up to like a certain part of your
knuckle
or like above the surface of the rice to like a certain knuckle, then that was like the right amount of water. But everybody also said if you open the pot up and the rice is done and there's too much water, like boil it off.
Right.
And if you open it up and the rice is still tough, but the water's gone, then add more water, and put the lid back on. And I thought that that was really a great thing to hear because it is such this intimidating thing.
I think what that reflects too is like you said, like an intimate relationship with your process. And it's like my Aunt Preetha makes a lot of rice, a lot of long grain rice. She's cooking it in the same pot every time. So it's like she's not measuring. She's just throwing it in there. She's got her like she knows where her finger is supposed to go and like how much it's supposed to be. But, you know, for me, and, you know, I have my method at home, but I still feel like having that ratio, having that like 1 cup of rice to 1 1/4 cup of water thing, and that being like 1 cup of rice, 1 1/4 cup of water, 18 minutes, 10 minutes. That's a thing that I can remember, and it'll be the same every time. And, you know, I think in order to have that kind of flexibility, you have to have like almost an even more intimate relationship.
I'm more of a 1-to-1 person with all of my white rice. Yeah,
oh, this
1-to-1.
You taught me how
to
make rice.
I'm just like, I don't know. It's amazing when you go back and you think and you're like, 18 minutes, where the heck did I get that from? But
1-to-1.
1-to-1 and like 11 minutes.
11?
Yeah. Always for short grain, which I'm also rinsing a little bit. The other thing that's really good to do that I didn't know, but it totally makes intuitive sense. Like beans and like other grains, you should let the rice sit for 10 minutes, 20 minutes in the water.
Hold the phone.
Yeah, true story. And it will just cook more evenly.
So you're kind of like giving it a mini soak.
Mini soak.
Mini soak.
And then.
Un petit soak.
Some people drain and then let the rice sit.
Well, who did you hear? This is also.
So there was Ed Lee from Chicago, Rachel Yang in Seattle. Then there was Chef Takashi from Takashi Restaurant, who very sadly passed away this past year. Really nice guy. Oh. He said his grandmother would rinse it, drain it, and then let it sit for half an hour. And so he was teaching me how to do it. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. How come you let it sit for half an hour? And he just laughed and said, I don't know. So there's like that too. It's like, it's just, that's how she did it. So that's how I do it. And the other thing that, and these were all Korean American chefs, so this is sort of a specific thing, but nobody puts salt in their rice.
You know?
And so I stopped doing that too. I used to always put rice, and then the Carol Lolly way is that you put not only rice, but you put like a tablespoon of butter in there when it's cooking. And so it's like buttery rice from the beginning. There is a school of thought that like the rice is, when everything else on the table is like really aggressively seasoned and flavor forward, that rice is your kind of like the blank canvas.
Totally.
Which I totally get that too, but I love salted rice.
I know. You know, it's like Lauren often, you know, her mom, who's part Korean and part Filipino, does not put any salt in the rice. And I, because you taught me how to make rice, this one recipe from, you know, whatever, 2011 or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that you don't even remember, said to salt it, so I put the salt in it.
I like it salted, too.
I like it, you know.
Another
I like
thing
it both ways.
That is delicious, I don't know if you've ever done this, but tomato rice, where you can take some of the, like, if you ever drain off the liquid from your can of San Marzano tomatoes, or you have... like a day old or a seconds tomato, and you can just like grate that up, putting some of that to replace some of the liquid with tomato water.
So you can just put it in like the measuring cup and then
exactly.
fill it up the
so
rest
if you
of
have
way.
Like half a cup of tomato liquid right. and then you supplement with the rest of the water and then you get tomato rice.
Ooh, that sounds very good.
That would be good with the sour cream.
That sounds very, you know, I really, that's, that makes me think of one of my favorite ways to eat rice, which is with buttered tomatoes on top.
Ooh. Oh
just
yeah.
Warm.
You
oh,
did
yeah,
that. Buttered yeah, tomato yeah, recipe. That recipe. That was really good.
Just like butter, tomatoes, rice.
Yum. Mm, so good.
But you're also bringing up an interesting point, too, which Adam wanted to talk about. He likes...
Adam Rappaport. Our boss. Mm-hmm.
He was talking about, you know, sautéing a little bit of onion, garlic, before you did all of the...
Pilaf.
Putting the rice in there. And to me, I was like, that's a pilaf. He was like... That's not a pilaf, just a little bit of onion. And I'm like,
it's 100% a pilaf.
If you're adding stuff, you're sizzling aromatics, yes. and then you're adding the rice in, and you're kind of getting it to that where it's almost translucent,
yeah.
and then you're adding the liquid.
Yeah.
That's a pilaf.
100%.
100% pilaf.
Which is a great thing. And you can also add dry spice to the beginning of that. You can put some paprika, as we were discussing mm-hmm. earlier. You
curry
could put
powder.
A little curry powder. Yeah, mm-hmm. a little turmeric. Or
a little bear.
It would be great.
Yeah.
Sumac, whatever. Ooh. Coriander, cumin, what are you going to do?
Yeah, the more the merrier.
Claire Saffitz did a whole pilaf, like, matrix thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
I
so that should be online, too. And that's really nice. And that is, like, a little more luscious, and it's very flavored, and, like, they come out really shiny and
right.
super classic in its own way. The other mm-hmm. thing that I love to do, and I really only started doing in the past couple of years, is taking... cooking rice like early in the day, and a rice cooker would be really perfect for this, and then, you know, pressing it into like an onigiri shape,
okay.
so like
so
making
like
a little
kind of
patty
triangle.
Out of it, yeah, whatever mm-hmm. it doesn't, but it could be a circle or a thing mm-hmm. but where it needs to have some of that glutinousness
mm-hmm.
glutinous property to mm-hmm. it, so it'll hold together.
It's still gluten-free, nobody freak out, don't worry,
yeah. and then grilling that rice.
Carla.
If you're grilling, it's, I mean, grilled rice is like, it's everything. It's crispy. It's smoky. It is delicious in every way. And I could just eat the rice.
Similarly, love taking the rice that's been hanging out for a little bit, forming it into a little thing.
Yeah.
And then giving it just a little sear.
Crispy crisp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is really nice.
With a little chicken fat.
Do you use a nonstick skillet for that?
Yeah, I normally would.
Yeah.
There are a lot, you know, I find myself using my nonstick skillet.
Fat. Yeah, all those
more
little bits of
and
fat.
More often. Yeah.
Do you just save every time you make a braise or every time you're like making chicken thighs? Do you save your animal fat besides bacon? I know a lot of people save bacon fat.
It depends on the situation. Yes. Normally, yes. If I like, especially if I like seared off like a bunch of something with some like beefy fat, mm-hmm. like dry aged fat, and then you've got that, or you like trimmed, you know, some little fatty parts
yeah.
off a steak, and then you just
melt
render
that
and like
mm-hmm.
the cute little cast iron they don't really use for anything else, just on the back, and then you just have that.
It's good to have that, and
it's
that is delicious
that.
For crisping
it's
up rice.
It's good to have that. A podcast from Garland Emil.
That chicken with the ginger and the scallions, which also Adam and I talked about on a different episode. Yeah, chicken with crispy rice. So you have chicken stock, you rinse the rice, you put the rice in the skillet, in a nonstick skillet, and you're cooking it in the stock.
Oh.
And then once the rice is tender, 10 minutes, then you
it's covered
continue reducing
time.
It. Yeah. And the rice is cooked, you take the lid off, and then the residual chicken fat like goes down to the bottom, the liquid is boiled off, and then you just really need to like just trust what's happening, listen to it, it starts making little, it goes from making like the burbling noises to making the little crackling noises, and it's a little dry, yeah, and then the underside is like so golden brown and crispy.
Ooh, chicken and rice,
it's like the best of both worlds, because mm-hmm. you've got the tender and you've got the crispy.
Yeah, well, we really covered a lot of ground. Yeah. Not actually that much ground.
No, we covered a little bit of grain.
A little bit of grain. Just one grain at a time. Rome wasn't
built on
on grains.
I feel like we should... This is Rice Part 1.
Rice Part 1.
I mean, there's like those multi-part podcasts, right?
Yep.
So you could just come back and be like, we actually talked about nothing.
Yep. You just want a little us in like
just
little bite-sized pieces, just like a chopstick full of rice.
Just one little bit of rice.
One kernel of wisdom at a time.
So I think we should just do another rice because really we didn't even get into any of the long grain rices, any of the Persian rices, any of the... There's so many things. We didn't steam rice. We're all about... That's not steamed rice,
I know,
really.
That's confusing because people always call that steamed rice and it's not steamed rice.
I mean, there is steam.
There's steam.
And
but
rice.
There's also like, you know, yeah.
More liquido.
More liquido.
I want to make rice.
I want to make rice.
Love rice. Black rice we didn't talk about.
Green rice?
What?
Yeah, you know the green, the jade green.
Oh, yeah. Rice. Beautiful.
Bingo.
And then wild rice, which is grass.
Pass on the grass.
Emil, I hope they let us do this again.
God.
That's what I feel kind of like every
God
time
willing.
We do work.
I know.
Signing off.
Thanks, Carla.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So this year, it seems like a good Oscar year. Would you say that?
I would say so. I think it's the most kind of open-ended that we've had in a long time. Like, I feel like last year there was Moonlight or La La Land, there was Spotlight or The Revenant the year before. There was a kind of a binary thing.
I watched 3 minutes of La La Land on a plane recently, and I was just like, I can't deal with like these musical on a freeway. I was just like, And I just turned the channel and watched like Avengers or something.
I think that movie was sort of a love it or leave it proposition for a lot of
it.
People. Yeah, so there are a lot of smaller movies that all seem somewhat equally footed in terms of like will they win Best Picture or whatnot, which is exciting. It's consternating for people like myself who, you know, have to sort of predict these things and act like experts. And basically all we can say this year is I don't know. but like I think as a film goer, yeah, it's been
well. There's two approaches as a critic. There's what you would like to see win, and there's what you think will win.
Exactly. And I think that in years past, I have followed my heart instead of my head in predicting and then been proven totally wrong. So right. I think I have to be more cynical about it.
All right. We're going to come back to your predictions. But first question is, where will you be watching the Oscars this year?
I wish I had an exotic, exciting answer. A lot of my colleagues will be out in L.A. because Vanity Fair has the big Oscar party. I will be on a couch in Brooklyn by myself.
Yeah. What do you have to do to make the cut? Do you know?
I don't know. I've been at this company 4.5 years. I still do not know the answer to that.
Yeah. You don't even get to ask the question.
No.
All right. So will you have friends over or are you like, I'm working tonight. Yeah. I've got to be on.
I used to have friends over. I used to have a little thing every year. But, you know, increasingly because it's such a work night, I find that... it's not so much that I'll be distracted if I have friends over. It's that I don't want to immediately after the show ends be like, okay, you all have to leave because I have to write something.
Are you expected to be tweeting during the show?
There's no expectation of tweeting, but because they know that I will be doing it anyway. They know that I'm a hopeless addict. And,
just reflexively.
Right, yeah.
I enjoy Oscar night. I like getting together with people.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we go to our friends, Michael and Cheryl's, and they have a thing, and they invite a whole bunch of people over, kind of potluck style, and you bring dishes. It's interesting because I always... reflexively compare Oscar parties to the Super Bowl.
Sure.
Because they're only about a month apart or so.
And the Oscars.
A little bit more. Yeah. No, about a month. Yeah.
And the Oscars have been called the gay Super Bowl. I mean,
the gay, okay. There you go. Yeah. See? Yeah. I kind of expect the food to be a little chicer, a little bit more Hollywood, don't you?
Yeah, you know, you've got Wolfgang Puck doing his thing for the governor's ball or whatever. So yeah, you want a little of that class to trickle down to your home party. But it's more difficult because I think people are so focused on like puns or things that relate to the movie that they don't actually think about the cuisine. Maybe. Mm. Yeah.
Yes, I go more cocktail than like I was drinking Bud Light at the Super Bowl. I will not be drinking Bud Light at the Oscars.
Yeah.
I'll make myself like a vodka martini or something.
That
you know, like
great.
You kind of want that 1940s Hollywood glamour.
Sure. And you're in full tux, right?
Yeah. just like the Hollywood cover of the Vanity Fair issue.
Right. Yeah.
Tails, of course.
You have Annie come over to your house, shoot some photos.
Me and Channing Tatum hanging out in white tie. So like last year, I ended up making, there's only four of us, my wife, son, and our friend Gabe, and I made BA's best fried chicken sandwiches. And so this is like kind of, you know, everyone's fried chicken sandwiches are everywhere these days.
Yeah.
And you sort of marinate these. We did thighs. You can do thighs or boneless breasts. The recipe is on bonappetit.com for BA's best fried chicken sandwiches. You do a whole marinade, buttermilk, hot sauce sort of thing. And then do you ever do like fried chicken or anything?
I don't because I'm a little scared of the oil and everything like that.
Yeah, I get that. You know. But it's pretty easy. You set up a little dredging station.
Right, right.
So you take the breasty sort of thing or thigh, dip it in seasoned flour, shake it off. Then it goes into an egg wash, which is just beaten egg seasoned. Dip that, and then the third one, it goes back into flour, but the key, I don't know if he's falling asleep right now, or
no,
if he's intentionally
interested. I'm wrapped.
And then the key is in that third, that the secondary, but the third bin, but second flour bin, you take some like buttermilk and stuff, and you kind of put it in there and mush it up together, so it gets little like kind of nubbins, like chunks of flour.
Oh.
So then that coats it again, right. And that's where you get those big crags and like
chunks of fried.
Exactly.
That you want. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so then you fry it, and it doesn't have to be deep fried, but you want a high sided pot, like a Dutch oven, like an inch or so either side. Flip it over. And the reason I think this worked is that you can fry them and then put them on like a cooling rack, you know, like a cookie rack with the little racks so they don't sit in their own grease. And you can just keep them warm.
Yeah.
And then when it's time to eat, you then assemble your sandwich. I had some coleslaw, some avocado, a little hot sauce. It was quite good.
This sounds good.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have cocktails. And I think, though, I'm just going to keep talking.
Please.
With the Oscars, however, we're East Coasters. And this is, I don't like the fact that we're East Coasters for these sort of things because the Oscars doesn't start till 8 p.m., right?
Yeah, 8 or 8:30. Sometimes it's 8:30
right?
And it goes till
forever.
Midnight. Yeah.
So I think I'm kind of like a lot of times the food is coming out during the red carpet.
Right.
Which is fun.
Yeah.
Because that's a whole thing also. Do you get involved in that as a critic?
At the red carpet?
Yes.
I watch it, both as critic, I guess, and as just kind of appalled spectator, especially these days when, you know, we have all these political things happening, Me Too and all that. The inanity of some of like the E coverage or whatever is just does not match the seriousness of the moment.
No.
Which I think is fascinating.
Still have to ask who are you wearing?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Like fanatically and breathlessly.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, always. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and because they have to feed that information then to their fashion correspondents and
Okay. So let's talk about this year's best pictures or just in general. Any notable food scenes from the Oscars this year?
You know, it's funny. We had Carla Lali Music on our podcast, mm-hmm. Little Gold Men, and I was reminded of how many food scenes there are in this year's nominees. Between Call Me By Your Name's Peach, you know, scene. I don't know if you've seen that movie.
I've seen like nothing. But I'm familiar with it. Guys,
a teenage boy has a relations with a peach, let's say. From that, there's
a very ripe peach.
Yeah, they're these beautiful Italians. It's, you know, it's summer.
It's
everything
Italy. Everything's,
you know,
perfect.
It's all a metaphor for sex. There's that. There's they eat a lot of hard-boiled eggs in The Shape of Water, which is not a food I like. But, like, they somehow make it romantic, weirdly, in that movie. And then in two different movies set in England around the same time, you have Phantom Thread, which has a lot of breakfast food in it, notably toast. Loudly
toast.
Buttered toast.
Much, oh, I like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Daniel Day-Lewis's character is infuriated by the noise. And then you have Gary Oldman's Winston Churchill being served this heaping breakfast complete with booze and champagne and everything.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah.
I want to talk about why there aren't more food scenes in movies. Like, food scenes are basically the sex scenes of movies, but they can be for all ages.
Yeah.
They're very they can be very sensual
absolutely.
And suggestive. And people remember them. Like, we can talk about the food scene in Goodfellas, mm-hmm. like when they're in the jail and shaving the garlic, and everyone remembers it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a visceral thing. And, you know, I sometimes wonder, you know, I can watch Project Runway and I'm like, okay, I can see the clothes. I can make an assessment of whether the dress looks good or whatever. And yet I still watch Top Chef with the same rapt attention,
yeah.
even though I can't taste the food. I'm just kind of trusting Padma and Tom to tell me if it's good or not. But there's something so visceral about watching them make it and even watching people eat it.
It's not easy to do because I think there's been a lot of mediocre food films.
Yeah.
I thought Chef was kind of like I thought the food scenes in Chef with what's his name?
Jon Favreau
yeah. and everybody. And it was kind of, I don't want to say a B movie, but you know, it's a little formulaic, but the scenes where he's making the grilled cheese and it's like, shh, and then crunching it in half. And it was passionate and loving the food scenes in the way that the movie with what's his name from Silver Linings Playbook,
Bradley Cooper,
his
burnt
was not. I watched that and I'm like, I didn't believe that anyone in that movie actually cared about food.
Yeah, that movie did not interact with its food. The Chef, I thought was such a pleasurable experience because it just really leaned into the preparation.
And you could tell the people who were working on it
that they knew,
really believed
it.
Burnt was supposed to be more of one of the angry London chefs from the 90s sort of thing, and Michelin 3-star, but it was just like, it was that sort of food as presentation, and you're like,
Yeah, the product didn't so much matter as much as the process, and I don't know. But like, I'm somebody who watches, you know, I find that like watching cooking process really calming and really mesmerizing, and so I like a movie like Chef where they actually show you them doing it rather than, you know, we just have to trust that Bradley Cooper is brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you watch The Queen? The Crown.
The Crown. Yes. I do watch The Crown. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I work for Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
I think we have to be up on the royals. Yeah.
You have a new editor in chief for Deka Jones. I'm curious to know like whether there'll be the same fixation on the royals and in your anglophilic ways in the coming year.
I think that it will remain. I think that maybe the tone will change. I don't know. But yeah, we're still deep in on it.
So speaking of Winston Churchill and. You watch that, and I'm in it right now and love the show. The amount of alcohol and tobacco they consume on a daily basis, all day, every day. I don't understand how people actually did that.
And people did. I mean, Princess Margaret, who was probably the chief person consuming that stuff, Elizabeth's sister, she really was that in real life. And it really took a toll on her later in life, but she lasted a good 70 something years doing that every day.
It's like they've got the Keith Richards DNA. And Churchill in the show is already about 79 or 80.
Yeah.
And he's always got a drink in his hand and a cigar in his hand.
Oh yeah, he was notorious as well, like from morning to night. The level of liquor would change. It would start kind of lighter and then go to brown by the end.
It would get darker.
But
Philip, the husband, now Prince, he never became king. I never understood that. But he's constantly just grabbing a rocks glass and pouring himself some scotch.
Yeah.
Like in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
I mean,
how do you function?
But let alone your liver, but like you have to like talk to people and make decisions and like, you know, I don't,
A couple other random questions.
Yeah.
Well, how often do you ever just go to the theater to see a film or do you not these days?
It's very rare that I do. This time of year, January, February, obviously we're looking forward to the Oscars, but like the movies coming out aren't always that exciting. And so like I didn't go to see a screening of 50 Shades Freed, the third, you know, installment in that. So I might go pay to see that. I definitely want
to. No, you're not going to go pay to
see
it.
I might do it.
No,
I have some
not.
Friends who want to see it. The other one that is Paddington 2. I missed a screening of it. I hear it's wonderful.
Paddington 1, or the first Paddington, I took my kid. I very much enjoyed
that's
that
That's a nice
one.
Movie.
Very
yeah,
charming.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has, who plays the dad? Oh, the guy from.
Oh, Hugh Bonneville.
And was he the
Downton
one?
Abbey.
Downton Abbey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's
and Nicole
good.
Kidman's the villain in the first one. Yes. And I believe Hugh Grant is the villain in the second one. Yeah, so I might do that, but my problem is that like I know we have like Alamo Drafthouse here in New York now, and we have all these other theaters.
What do you think about those? So,
you know, I've only been to a theater where they serve food once, and that was in Boston. I was home visiting my parents over Thanksgiving last year, I think it was, and my parents were like, "Oh, we have this new, you know, theater. It's really fancy, whatever." So we went, and the movie we chose to see was Manchester by the Sea,
which
you know, Massachusetts set movie. I'd seen it already, but
you agreed to go see Manchester by the Sea with your parents?
Yeah, I hadn't seen it. I saw it at Sundance, so it had been months since I'd seen it, and I just wanted to go to this fancy theater because I'd never experienced that before. And it was nice, and the seats were nice, and the food was fine. But because this is a wait service, about 15 minutes before the end of the movie, they have to go around dropping checks, and it just happened to coincide with Michelle Williams's big monologue. She's crying about their dead children, and it's the clip they showed in all of her, you know, Oscar reels and all that stuff. And they're going around dropping checks, and people are reaching for their wallets. And I was like, okay, this is a breakdown of the system. Like, this, they have to either wait or whatever. So I find that any, like we were talking about before, like any kind of distraction like that, it really takes away from the experience.
I am visibly, if not audibly, shaking my head right now. And I've been to one. There's one down here at the Seaport in downtown Manhattan called
the IPIC.
And they got the big, like, you know, first class airline seats, and you press the button and the waiter, and I find my mind focusing too much on the food and beverages.
Yeah.
B, they use way too much truffle oil, which drives me nuts. I'm like, no, I don't want truffle oil on French fries. Stop with the truffle oil already. Everything's a little bit too complicated by half. And then thirdly, the check sort of thing. And then you look at the check, you're like, oh my God, I spent how much? And like, then that's astounding.
Yeah.
If you are going to a normal Cineplex, are you a snack guy?
I am. Yeah. I'm usually a pretty boring popcorn person, but with like a lot of butter on it.
Do the spurt thing. Yeah. But don't you want them to be able to, I always feel like, can you fill it up halfway? I'll do the squirt and then I'll bring it back and you fill it up the other half and I'll do the squirt on top.
At the Landmark Sunshine, which is now no longer closed last month on Houston in the East Village, there was one person who worked the counter who would do that.
He would say,
do you want butter? And then he would fill it up a third, do some butter, then another third.
But a lot of the ones, they have like the self-serve butter.
Yeah, it's a self-serve.
But then you're already filled up at that point.
And I always feel this shame because I don't put on as much as I want because people are like waiting behind me and I just feel embarrassed.
But you need to grab a lot of napkins.
You do. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I've learned that lesson the hard way. Someone introduced me recently, I think it was like in a TV show or a movie, and then they tried it and I tried, is if you get popcorn, if it's in one of the tubs versus a bag, you can put like some kind of chocolatey or peanut buttery candy into the popcorn. Yeah. So you're kind of getting a sweet, salty thing.
What would you do? What would you put in?
Like maybe some like Reese's Pieces maybe. Mm. That's a good one. Yeah.
Peanut M&Ms.
Peanut M&Ms would be great. Yeah. So I think that kind of mix is, I mean, you know, your dentist is going to kill you, but whatever.
Okay. We're going to get to your picks. Yeah. Okay. Best picture. I'm going to run down. There's nine this year.
Yeah.
Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, speaking of Winston, Dunkirk, also kind of a Winston movie, not really, but British.
He's there virtually.
Get Out, Lady Bird, Phantom Thread, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri.
Yeah.
What do you think will win, and what would you like to win?
What I would like to win would be Get Out. I think that it's such an innovative, interesting movie. I think it speaks to our times much more, you know, closely than a lot of stuff this year. I don't think it will win. I think what will win, because when people are voting for, Academy members are voting for Best Picture, there's this weird preferential ballot thing. So there's all this math involved.
Yeah.
And we had someone on our podcast last week who basically broke it all down. And he said that it's not what people vote for number one. It's actually what people are going to vote for like four or five on their ballots. He thinks, and I agree with him.
But wait, but how do they tabulate? Is it only first place?
Right. And then if your ballot has one movie that didn't get enough first place votes, then they go to your number two. And that counts for first. So it's this whole weird thing.
But it's also
thing.
Confusing with this many nominees. You could get 13% of the vote.
Right.
And still win.
And this year especially is so crowded. So this is why we think it's going to go down to what's most often four or five on people's ballots, because they're going to keep throwing out number one votes or whatever. Anyway, Dunkirk is the one that we're predicting.
No, because Dunkirk is not winning.
We'll see.
I'm going to tell you why.
Okay.
Not enough people saw it. Correct. It wasn't like a big money Hollywood sort of thing.
I mean, I think people saw it. It's been out for so long.
It didn't do crazy gangbuster numbers.
It wasn't like huge.
It was decent.
Yeah.
You know, also why?
Right.
This is America, and it's not Saving Private Ryan. It's about a bunch of British guys at war, not a bunch of American soldiers at war.
Yeah.
So that's why it's not going to win.
Yeah. If it doesn't win, I think it will be Shape of Water.
Yes.
Because people love that movie. I think Del Toro probably will win Best Director. He's beloved in the industry, and it's, you know,
innovative guy.
Yeah, and he has this kind of like overdue quality about like the people are like, I can't believe
he won yet. What should he have won for in your mind?
Pan's Labyrinth, I think.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a beautiful movie. Yeah.
That Shape of Water is on my wife's date night list. That's what we're supposed to see, and that's what we've been trying to see, and just has not really happened yet. Do I need to see The Post? I've already seen All the President's Men like five times.
Yeah, I mean, The Post is fine. I would say that would be a great movie to watch on a plane.
I loved Lady Bird. I don't think that's got a...
No, I think, you know, and these should not be taken with, you know, given too much credit, but certain trades like Hollywood Reporter or The Wrap will do conversations with anonymous Oscar voters. And something that a lot of them have said is like, I like Lady Bird, but they kind of call it small or whatever, you know. Well, so I think that's
it's a nice film.
Yeah, it could win screenplay, right. But I doubt it.
Lead actor. Do I pronounce his name Timothée?
I mean,
Timothée.
Who the hell knows?
Chalamet. Yeah. He went to public high school in New York. His name is Timothy. His name is Timmy.
He dated Madonna's daughter.
Yeah. Call Me by Your Name. Daniel Day-Lewis. Phantom Thread. Daniel Kaluuya. Get Out, Gary Oldman, Darkest Hour, and Denzel. It sounds like we just get to call him Denzel. Roman J. Israel, Esquire. I've never even heard of that movie.
Very few people saw that movie. I am one of them. I think that Timothée...
Not a strong year.
Yeah, it's not a great Best Actor year, although there's some good stuff. There's great stuff in there. I think
you don't think it just goes to Daniel Day because he's Daniel Day-Lewis?
No, I think Gary Oldman's definitely going to win.
Gary Oldman.
Yeah, again, it's like he's overdue, whatever. Yeah,
Oh, he's never won.
No, and he was only nominated for the first time a few years ago. Okay, yeah. So I think he'll win. I would love Timothée Chalamet to win, but no.
Also, Timothée Chalamet, he is the one bad thing in Lady Bird. That was like a caricature of a character.
He's not great in that.
I roll my own cigarettes.
Right.
I'm not into currency. It's just like, dude, come on. He's like, bad boy. Lead actress, Sally Hawkins, Shape of Water, Frances McDormand, Three Billboards, Margot Robbie, I, Tonya, Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah.
Her real accent in real life is amazing. From Lady Bird and Meryl, what's called Meryl from The Post.
Yeah, Frances, Meryl Denzel. We can use one name.
Frances has got this locked up.
Frances is going to win. Sally should win. Yeah, that's what I think.
Director. So you got.
I think, Del Toro will win.
All right, Christopher Nolan from Dunkirk. From a technical standpoint, he could maybe.
I mean, the crazy thing about it is that, like, he has never been nominated before. This is his first nomination. Dunkirk is undeniably a masterful feat of direction. Yes. I think the thing that's holding him back in that category is that. That movie, while technically marvelous, doesn't have a lot of heart to it. There's not a lot of emotion to it. It's kind of cold, as a lot of his films are. And I think that people just aren't connecting with that.
I would say Jordan Peele doesn't have a chance in that he's going up against Nolan and P.T. Anderson and Guillermo del Toro.
I think that Gerwig and Peele being nominated is the win for them, essentially.
It seems like that with the Oscars sometimes. It's almost like, hey, you got to go through it a few times before you earn it.
Greta Gerwig is only the fifth woman ever nominated for Best Director, which is crazy.
I got to imagine that's going to change.
Yeah, I hope so.
Richard Lawson, thank you so much for joining us. That was fun.
Thanks for having me.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.